You're listening to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, recording from Washington, D.C.
And I'm your co-host, Katie Putz, also in Washington, D.C. How are you doing, Ankit?
Good to be back with you, Katie. This time, we're going to take our listeners through a tour of the massive logistical operation that is underway in India for the country's general election in 2024, which has just started and will continue through May. Really kind of a breathtaking exercise in democracy with more than 900 potential people voting across the country. So we'll talk a little bit about kind of the domestic stakes, the implications for foreign policy. We've revisited India's shifting foreign policy on this podcast quite regularly, and we'll talk about whether this election will result in any major changes, particularly if it does result, as many are expecting, in yet another strong mandate for Narendra Modi and the Bharatiya Janata Party, which has taken India's foreign policy in a more muscular direction informed by the party's propensity to seek kind of Hindu nationalist ideals overseas. So we'll talk a little bit about all of that. But Katie, maybe the place to start is to talk a little bit about the domestic stakes here. Elections are, in most democracies, about domestic issues, bread and butter, economic issues. So what are the issues that you'll be looking out for?
Yeah. So the I think for our listeners' benefit, we really need to comprehend just how large a democratic exercise this is. India's population is what, 1.4 billion. The registered voting population, I looked this up today, is nearly 970 million. And so this is really the world's largest electoral exercise. And it's, the voting is staggered in seven stages across the 28 states and eight union territories from April 19th until June 1st to elect 543 members of the Lok Sabha, which is the lower house of India's parliament. And from that, the prime minister will be selected. Now, this is essentially, a Modi running for a third consecutive term. And that's, I think that was really underscored in the BJP's election manifesto, which we will get into, I think, but some have called a Modi-festo, because it's essentially labeled, Modi's guarantees. So there's a sort of personalization of politics. And I think that's particularly interesting because when we think about how big India is and how essentially every Indian state is like a country unto itself and has its own political dynamics, and it's in that context that these votes are happening, the fact that Modi is essentially on every ballot when it comes to the BJP, that really, I think, resonates with voters. He's tremendously popular in India. But at the same time, there are considerable, like you said, bread and butter issues that Indians across the country are concerned about, everything from the economy, employment. There's certainly social issues in many states. The Muslim minority in India has deep concerns about the continued BJP rule. And so I think it will be important once the election is done to kind of look at how these different issues resonated and whether the sort of personality of Modi overrode that. I think this might be one of those elections where it's really, are you voting for Modi? Are you voting for somebody else? And that I think says things both about the Indian electorate and about the direction of the country. There are also, as you sort of forecasted, foreign policy implications for this and what continuity means for India as a country within the geopolitical milieu. So I guess I'll just throw it back to you, Ankit. What are you looking at when we're sort of in the midst of this election? What are you looking at and what are you expecting?
So, I think I am expecting, of course, foreign policy not to be the primary determinant of this election. But it is interesting that both the two major parties, Congress and BJP, there are, of course, literally hundreds of political parties in India, many in opposition, partnered with the Congress. But in any case, the two major parties have identified kind of distinct visions on sort of foreign policy that I think are interesting. There are sort of issue specific questions, including on China and Pakistan, India's two neighbors with which it has border disputes and chronic conflicts. The salience also domestically of many of these issues has sort of spiked in domestic politics in India, particularly China, since the 2020 border clashes between India and China, which resulted in the largest number of casualties there in about 40 years in June 2020. And so The big thing, though, is the BJP's manifesto is pretty clear that voting for the BJP, as you sort of highlight, votes for BJP candidates are effectively a referendum on Modi's domestic and foreign policy leadership, that voting for the BJP will broadly result in continuity in India's foreign policy. And I think that is the big picture. From where I'm sitting, it seems like the BJP is touting its recent records of success, right? So that includes the hosting of the G20 last year, which is sort of prominently highlighted as an example of India's growing prominence in global affairs, right? India does continue to see itself fundamentally as a rising power that is increasingly able to take its rightful place in international politics. That's how the BJP frames it, and they frame sort of Modi's leadership on the world stage as allowing India to sort of take that rightful place, even if that results in controversies like when we discussed a few episodes ago, India's apparent involvement in extrajudicial assassinations overseas. Not an issue that's raised in the manifestos, but nevertheless something that I think has informed at least how much of the outside world now sees India's willingness to take greater risks. India also, you know, I think positions itself in the BJP manifesto and the Congress manifesto as a leader for the global South more broadly. Both parties emphasize India's role in sort of leading the global South, including in sort of multilateral settings. The BJP describes India as the voice of the global South, which is an interesting framing, somewhat sort of similar to how China describes itself in similar settings, or at least used to as a spokesperson for the world's developing countries. So there's a lot going on there, but maybe we can sort of, you know, talk about some of those issues. And then, of course, you know, there's the major bilateral relationships that India has with countries like the United States, of course, with Japan, with Australia, its Quad partners, where there is broadly a I think further continuity to be expected. Oh, just one last issue, Katie, that I think is really interesting. You know, you talked a bit about India's growing domestic political problems when it comes to minorities, including the Muslim minority. Here, I think it's interesting that the Congress promised in its manifesto to effectively repair India's international image, saying that the present government's intolerance, I'm just quoting from the manifesto, the present government's intolerance of dissent and suppression of human rights have damaged India's reputation overseas. So that's an interesting kind of assertion to be made. It sort of gets into some of the domestic political controversies that have occurred in India when Rahul Gandhi, the senior Indian Congress leader, made similar comments overseas and received quite a bit of criticism from the BJP and BJP-aligned media in India. So I think there is also a bit of a foreign policy debate between the two parties about how India's domestic situation is being perceived overseas.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, one question that I have is, you know, I think the current assumption, the current presumption is that Modi and the BJP will be successful in staying in power. Whether that comes to fruition or not, would a change in government in India change India's geopolitical sort of behavior in any kind of effective way? You know, when you start to think about, say, India's relationship with Russia and India's relationship with the United States, would a Congress-led or an India, the India alliance, which makes it hard to talk about but is quite interesting on paper, if that alliance finds itself in power, would it make any different moves? I'm not so certain. I saw Rahul Gandhi speak in Washington several months ago, and he seemed sort of didn't have a real separate vision when it came to foreign policy. Somebody had asked him about the Russia relationship because there's sort of structural, the explanation that he gave, as I remember, it was sort of there are structural reasons that India has this relationship with Russia that it does, primarily regarding energy. But I'm curious your sort of take on, in these manifestos and in sort of what we can sort of guess these different parties would do, would they really steer India in a different direction? And then we can kind of come back to the reputation question, because I do think that is the one area that would be different, but I'm curious about the larger geopolitical question.
Yeah, so no, I think I agree with your instinct there. I think, you know, India's broader, you know, the motivation of India's grand strategy under both the last 10 years of BJP rule and before that Congress rule has essentially been seeking economic development, right? That has been the story of post-Cold War, post-economic liberalization India. And I think that will continue regardless of what government comes into power, what the specific coalition breakdowns turn out to be in the Lok Sabha after the general election. At the margins, though, some of the sort of security issues pertaining to China and Pakistan would probably be managed with different types of judgment, so to speak. I mean, Congress had traditionally practiced strategic restraint vis-a-vis Pakistan that the BJP shuffled off with rather in rather dramatic form in 2019 with the Balakot airstrikes against Pakistan, for instance, which was the first use of conventional air power by India against Pakistan since the 1971 war, right? And so under the BJP, I think India's approach to managing security issues has changed. Of course, the China discussion, I think, is rather interesting because Congress has been very critical of the BJP for trying to, what the Congress says is the BJP has tried to sort of brush the China issue under the rug and sort of ignore it as the PLA has built up border infrastructure, sort of ingressed into India-held territory, so on and so forth. So on the margins, I think some of those issues would change. And then there's sort of the neighborhood policy questions that I didn't talk about. You know, there's been this whole row with the Maldives that we haven't talked about on this podcast that has manifested in a lot of kind of nationalism and sort of criticism of the Maldives. And frankly, signaling that India could coerce the Maldives more overtly as a small country rather dependent on India. There's sort of border issues with immigration, including illegal immigration from Myanmar and Bangladesh, that are a sort of hot issue for particularly the BJP voter base. That you know, there are some differences between the two parties, but the big picture would remain the same. I think on these questions about, you know, Russia, the United States, the Quad, India would broadly kind of remain within, you know, where it has. There are strong structural reasons for India to favor closer ties with Russia, including sort of energy trade and reliance on Russian transfers for maintenance and spare parts when it comes to maintaining India's military capabilities, which have a long legacy of dependency on Russian and Soviet technology. So that, too, I think would sort of remain part of the picture.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think the neighborhood policies are particularly interesting, but maybe a little bit under the scope of geopolitics, though. You know, I think the reputation question that you brought up earlier seems to me to be the one area that there would be some difference, or at least an attempted difference. There's no telling what Congress would actually do if it was in power at this particular moment. But there has been sort of, I think, over the last decade of Modi being in power, there has been increased discussion about Modi having authoritarian tendencies, about the Hindu right in India. What do you see as sort of the geopolitical implications, if at all, of these issues? You know, I don't think they have necessarily affected, say, India's relationships with the larger Muslim world, but the same can be said of China, Xinjiang, and the larger Muslim world. So I'm just curious your thoughts on sort of that bridge between the domestic and the geopolitical.
Yeah, no, I'd love to get your take on that too. I mean, you know, I think there's a view in India now that India is simply too important to too many countries, where these kinds of issues will actually end up derailing its relations, right? So I think that's been true with the Gulf. It's been true with the United States. You know, it's been interesting because the U.S. under the Biden administration has periodically raised concerns about sort of India's human rights record, the rising, rising intolerance in India, growing illiberalism, but it hasn't derailed the relationship at all. You know, Modi was celebrated in Washington in the summit last year, which was sort of regarded as a success. India continues to be a major partner for the United States in the Indo-Pacific, partner in the context of the Quad as well. So I think this has created a permissive environment for the BJP where it can sort of exercise a more, you know, it can sort of implement that Hindu nationalist vision of foreign and domestic policy without necessarily suffering consequences internationally. The exception, of course, has been Canada, where the India-Canada relationship has taken a big nosedive after the accusations of Indian involvement in an extrajudicial assassination on Canadian soil. But, you know, I think what was telling about that episode was, in a way, the Indian reaction, which was sort of very strong and very incensed, kind of taking Canada to probably the second worst bilateral relationship that India has after Pakistan, at least for the short term. So I think we will continue to see that tendency kind of persist. Whether the Congress would, you know, change things, I think probably, but again, I you know, they're probably not going to end up on top after this election, so I think it will really be you know, another BJP term with probably the trend lines as we've seen continuing. But what's your sense?
Yeah, I mean, I think I can't help but sort of draw at least personality parallels between Modi and Donald Trump. I think there's sort of a big personality aspect to both of them as politicians that essentially gets voters to overlook many of the details. And I think that it does fit into kind of a global trend of sort of rising both nationalism and populist sort of rhetoric, carrying sort of parties to electoral victory. And when you're electorally victorious on a platform that maybe demonizes one group of people, if it's useful, then you do it. And I think that might have longer term consequences that are hard to sort of chart out. You know, I think this can create the kind of grievance structure that gives rise to militant groups and terrorist attacks. And I think that's the kind of stuff that I worry about when it comes to India. It has such a large, it is such a big, complicated country. And I think those of us on the outside don't see the on the ground impact of some of the things that Modi, for example, in a recent speech sort of referred to Muslims as infiltrators, which is a reference that is often used for Bangladeshis and people who have been in India for a very long time but are not Indian. And this kind of sort of conspiracy mindset that Muslims are proliferating. I think one of the phrases that comes up occasionally is the quote unquote love jihad. And so I think that kind of creates this atmosphere of just distrust that is eventually destabilizing, even if in the moment for the BJP, it's a unifying kind of thing. It unifies their voter base, and their voter base is large enough to get them elected. But I don't know that it is the sort of recipe for long-term harmony in India, which is a very large and very diverse and has always been a very diverse country historically and currently. And I think that gets a little bit lost. And so that does concern me in the long run. But like you said, I do think it seems likely that the BJP will win this election. But again, it's hard to predict. We don't know. There's a lot of voting to be done. And it'll be up to Indians to decide. And I think one of the things we did not discuss, but I just want to mention, when we look back on this election, it'll be interesting to look at some of the information tactics that are used. There have been several rounds of deep fake videos, sort of quote unquote fake news and sort of manufactured things. And I think there will be some analysis that needs to be done about the source of that, those kind of tactics and the effect of those on voters and voters' opinions. But that's certainly something for the disinformation crowd to look into.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think it bears saying not only is this the largest exercise in democratic vote casting, but it is the largest exercise of this kind since artificial intelligence technologies proliferated in the way that they have. So, yeah, there's going to be a lot of mischief that I think permeates the information space in the course of this election. Katie, I want to thank you as always for joining me.
No, it's always a pleasure, Ankit.
Great. And I'm sure we'll be back to take a look at the outcomes of this Indian election after the results become known in May. In the meantime, thanks to all of our listeners for listening. As always, if you like what you heard on the podcast, make sure you subscribe. And if you've been a subscriber for a while, please do leave us a review. You can do that anywhere you get your podcasts. It really helps us get the word out about the show. So we really do appreciate that. And if you do have suggestions for future episodes, feel free to reach out to either myself or Katie. You can find us on social media or via email at the Diplomat's website. Thanks a lot for listening, and we'll be back soon with more.